Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is The Guardian.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
Welcome to the Final Word Ashes Daily. I'm Emma John, and I'm here in the UK, where those of us with an internet connection and the stomach for it have been following England's last gasp attempt to draw the second test. Over in Adelaide, my colleagues Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon have been following the action in the gathering gloom and possibly musing on the nature of pathetic fallacies. The light was fading, the shadows were growing, the fielders were clustered round the batters like vampires circling their next victim. Yes, it was another outdoor showing of twilight here at the Adelaide Oval. Unfortunately for England, there was to be no breaking dawn. Thanks to Joss Butler and Chris Wokes, England had maintained just enough hope throughout the afternoon to make the draw seem more than an academic theory. England had lost Ollie Pope in the third over of the day, giving interim captain Steve Smith his fifth catch of the game and even more reason to feel pleased with himself. And when Ben Stokes lost his battle with Nathan Lyon to a reviewed LBW, England were 105 for 6, with 2.5 sessions still to survive. But Joss Butler wanted his own shot at redemption. After his 15-ball duck in the first innings, he scored his first runs of the second off an edge between keeper and slip, which constituted Alex Carey's first mistake of the game. A couple more nicks landed short of the cordon, and more than once Jai Richardson had the ball whistling past his bat. But Butler toughed it all out, and even reeled off one backfoot drive that offered a glimpse of his dazzling one-day alter ego. At the other end, Wokes played strokes. It had worked for him in the first innings, when he was one of only 4 England batters to reach double figures, and it worked for him here, until it didn't, driving Richardson for 4, then immediately missing the ball that nipped back into him. 45 overs to bat, and 3 wickets left. Ollie Robinson made a 39-ball stand, and when he was gone, Stuart Broad had a leg before appeal overturned on DRS to take England into the final session. In the end, almost too poignantly, it was Butler himself who gave the game away. Richardson forced him back in his crease, and Butler, looking for a single, took a while to notice he'd stepped on his stumps. The game ended just a quarter of an hour later, with Australia 275 runs in credit, and England left, once again, in the dark. Now over to Jeff and Adam for the last rite.
So it's game over at Adelaide in the 15th session. It got all the way to the bitter end, and then Joss Butler stood on his stumps. I mean, what an amazing thing to happen. It happens so infrequently in Test cricket, full stop. But at that particular juncture, Butler had faced 207 balls for 26. This is a guy who's made like a number of one-day centuries that have taken place in fewer than 60 balls or something like that. I mean, this reminded me of AB de Villiers making 33 from 220 balls here, actually saving a test match in 2012, same ground. But a prodigiously talented ball striker. But for him to do what he did today and to bat for such a long time, for it all to fall apart the way that it did, it was a staggering intervention on that final session. And Australia wrap it up shortly thereafter.
It was quite literally staggering because he slipped over. His back foot slipped as he jumped back, because he was quite sensibly, he was playing really deep in his crease because Richardson was bowling short quite a bit, and Butler was using that to get a bit more time to be able to deflect the ball away. He was trying to farm the strike a bit because he was batting with Stuart Broad, and he'd managed it so nicely up until this point. I really feel for him because, I mean, getting out to a delivery that has the better of you is one thing, but something like that, he must have just been so tired, having been concentrating for so long. And also the fact that he turned it around from Pope getting out so early. So Mitchell Starc bowls one quickly across him, slants it across, edge into the slip. Steve Smith catches it. And that's the sort of thing that means a team is going to slide. You know, they're going to be all out quickly and get it over and done with. That's the way it's supposed to go. But he didn't follow the script. And as poor as England's batting has been from the top six, it was the keeper and four bowlers, effectively, who kept them in it and kept some hope. Because at the point he got out, what was left, about 25 overs? It was unlikely. You'd be thinking Broad would get out at some point, Anderson would get out at some point. But it was possible at that point. There was a glimmer.
Yeah, I said on the call that it went to script in the end. It just took a lot longer than they thought it was going to take. And, I mean, this test match mirrored the test played here 4 years ago so closely for so much of it, even down to wickets falling early on the fifth day. And on that occasion, England lost 6 for 57 in 22 overs and we were out of here by dinner time. And that's what I thought was going to happen. And it probably would have happened if Alex Carey moved comfortably to his right. I mean, it would have required a dive, but it's a straightforward chance in front of first slip. Warner made room for the dive even at first slip, but Carey doesn't go. The ball by sex keeper and first slip. Butler off the mark. Otherwise, we're talking about three dreadful drop catches and a pair, and you're probably talking about, I mean, maybe even replacing him for Melbourne, but instead he shows that he's more than just a pretty face. And look, we knew that with Butler. We know that he's made of tough stuff, but that was important for him. I think that'll go down as, you know, maybe one of his most important test innings, which sounds daft given they lost the match by 275 runs and that he fell in the circumstances in which he did and they didn't win it anyway and all the rest of it. But just providing some belief for him, for himself as much as anything else, that he can duke it out with this attack and he has the powers of concentration that can extend to hour after hour after hour. Not anyone can do that. Not any sort of generic white ball thrasher can do that. You need to have another bit to you, and Butler has. So that was reinforced today, and his contribution with Wokes, they've had it for 31 and a half overs, I think it was. I reckon there was about a 10-minute spell there just before Wokes gets out. Second new ball hasn't worked. Pitch is looking pretty flat. Lyon's back on, albeit Lyon is a threat with the hard ball. But, you know, the very fact that they didn't stick with the seam attack with the second new ball, we all assumed that Mitchell Starc would bust open England's middle and lower order there and then, but that didn't happen. So, you know, I think it was about 10, 15 minutes where it's not as though we thought England were going to save it from there, but it was like, well, it's genuinely on here. You know, the great escape is on here, in much the same way that we experienced that extraordinary Australia draw against Pakistan at Dubai. It had that energy to it from my perspective here.
It was possible. The possibility was you could see it on the horizon anyway.
Yeah, I think that's it. All it is at that stage of a test match, it's just like if you can break it down to what seems like an achievable bite, a big enough bite to put in your mouth and swallow. And I feel like, you know, 30 overs was that when they took the final 15 minutes. It became 26 for the final session. You know, if Butler doesn't stand on his stumps, I mean, you know, all irrelevant now, but just acknowledging that it was closer to them saving it than it will look in the final analysis of this game.
So come back to that partnership, that point where it's broken. So Wokes has made 44, batted really nicely for the most part. Mitchell Stark's got a bit of a back twinge. He's not looking comfortable when he's bowling. Cameron Green's got a slight side problem. The backroom staff have said they don't want him to bowl. Smith is prepared to use him if he absolutely has to, but doesn't want to. Lyon's been bowling a lot, and he's tired. And it's Jai Richardson who gets the breakthrough with what I think is pretty fair to call unplayable. Like, if I heard a lot of stuff on commentary saying Wokes was pushed back by the short ball he was playing back and thus he didn't get forward to the ball that castled him. If he had got forward to it, he would have been hit on the pad and been leg before.
It
jagged in off the seam so dramatically that it pitched well outside off and knocked over middle stump. And if he'd got forward to it playing the line that he thought it was coming down on, he would have got nowhere near it either. So it just an extraordinarily skillful piece of bowling. When Jai Richardson started the day, he would have been unsure as to whether he or Michael Nisa would be the ones likely to play in Melbourne if Josh Hazlewood misses out. There wouldn't be any doubt now that it will be Richardson. That piece of skill, the pace that he had to push Butler back that brought about the mistake, you know, the credit does go to the bowler for that wicket. And then he picks up the last one as well with James Anderson caught off an edge. He'd knocked over the openers last night. 5 for 42 to win a test match in an Ashes match in your third test as an Australian player, having not played for nearly 3 years, is an extraordinary effort.
It's special stuff. And look, I mean, is Richardson as quick as the bowler we saw 2 years ago? Like, I don't think he is. Like, I don't think out and out as quick. But is he more of a handful on the available evidence of what we've seen? I think he is. I know he didn't take a wicket in the first innings, but that opening spell when he kept beating the bat time and time again, I mean, he could have got in the book quite early on there, and he didn't, and he did last night instead. And he took wickets across four separate spells. I think that's noteworthy too. It wasn't like he got them in a burst. He had to come back and back up and back up and back up. Different times of the day, resilient across 19.1 overs there after putting in a lot of work in the first innings as well. I think that it's a great milestone for him, but also a crucial building block. Because when you talk about pecking order, I mean, Hazelwood, Cummins, Stark, you can pick whatever order you want, but they are the big three and have been for 4 or 5 years now. You need depth. And Nisa didn't do anything wrong this week, by the way. He could have easily been the guy with the wickets next to his name, but it was Richardson instead. They play 9 test matches in Asia next year, and we know when they go to Asia, they tend not to play, you know, straight up and down the big three as such. They tend to mix it up a little bit. And if there ends up being a situation where Richardson or Nisa have to play bulk cricket in, say, Pakistan, no dramas. I mean, that has been answered this week, I think, in Adelaide, on a hard, flat pitch for the most part, where they had to work hard and toil hard for their wickets. And then that dismissal of Wokes that went through the gate, that was gorgeous. Much as it was last night when he picked up Rory Burns and set him up around the wicket, and when he took Hamid's thumb off to get him caught behind. Really high quality wickets, and he's a super classy operator who has just kind of put out a big statement on a huge stage. And yeah, remember that.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Name.
Nathan Lyon as well, you know, took 2 wickets, which doesn't look dominant on the scoreboard, but so significant.
Yeah.
The way he was switching over and around the wicket, changing things up constantly, had the variety, had that sort of last day mojo back, lots of close chances, got Stokes playing back to him a lot, and then got the quicker one that just straightened a little bit from around the wicket and went on to hit him in line. Stokes reviewed,
Yeah.
It was hitting the leg stump, so it was almost that ball from Headingley, but not quite, because Stokes was so far back on his stumps. And then coming through to get Ollie Robinson as well, which was important by that point, and that was clever from Lyon as well, because he'd been over the wicket to Robinson a lot, looking to get him at short leg, came back around the wicket and bowled it almost a straight one. It had a little bit of turn on it, but much less so than the ones that he'd been ripping into Robinson. And that one skids across, gets the edge into the hands at slip. Really good piece of bowling. Lyon's now got the most wickets for Australia at Adelaide Oval and deserves it.
Yeah, equal with Warne on 56 all-time at Adelaide, actually, but with 2 fewer test matches and going at 3 fewer runs per wicket. So that says a little bit. If he's kind of out-bowled Warne at this venue on that measure, that tells you a lot, actually. And a ground that, you know, isn't historically known, I suppose, even in pink ball context, for being a spinner's paradise necessarily. It used to keep low here in the old days towards day 4 and 5, and the seamers used to run amok rather than turning big like it used to in Sydney. With Lyon, he bowled so frugally through the test. That was a criticism last year against India. He'd lost the ability to tie up an end. He wasn't bowling bulk maidens. Well, in this test match, he bowled 16 in the second innings after sending down 11 in the first. So 27 maidens in a test. That's really good going. And that review for Stokes, just to go through that in a bit more detail, Well, first of all, you know how sometimes you hear a piece of commentary that just comes true and it's a beautiful thing? Chris Rogers called that perfectly half an hour before. He goes, well, this is how he'll get Stokes just like this. And so he did. But I love the way that... Remember when Steve Smith was captain the first time around? It was truly scattergun. I mean, I think he's the worst reviewer I've ever seen. Is that a reasonable... I've never seen anyone as bad as Smith. First time around as captain,
Coley's pretty bad.
That's fair. He's as bad as Coley. Right? He was as bad as Coley. I love the way he went through it. Ask Cameron Green what doing on height. You know, and I'm not saying that asking your backward point or your gully is the only thing you do, but he had 15 seconds and he used them well. He consulted Lyon last,
also,
and Lyon's like...
How does Cameron Green gauge height if he's looking at it from about 9 feet in the air? How does he know where it's hitting anyway?
Yeah, true enough. But nevertheless, they went through that process. Then he went to Lyon with about 5 seconds to go, and Lyon says, if the height's fine, it's hitting leg stump, you should review. It's like quite a mature, like sensible, reasoned way of going about it. Lovely piece of bowling. I love the deliberative process, as I mentioned just then. They earned that. And at that stage, 2 wickets in the first, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes maybe, as I said off the top, I sort of thought we would be, you know, recording this in the sunlight and going out for dinner and those types of things. But that preceded the fantastic partnership. But yeah, absolutely. Lyon in the test takes, is it 4 wickets, 5 wickets all up, 5 all up, but he bowled better than that. He'll bowl worse than that and take 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 in matches. He has before and will again. So Lyon absolutely has his mojo back, no question.
Chris Wokes, the specialist number 8, seems to have been being picked in this team for that purpose. It almost paid off. He almost did the job for them. But I think for England, there's a risk in trying to turn this into too much of a positive. I know that sounds bizarre for a team that's in the doldrums, but all of the immediate kind of response can be, oh, well, they've fought hard and they can take something out of this. Their batting didn't. Their specialist bats didn't. They didn't fight hard. They folded again. And this kind of escape, while it would have been vastly cheering for them had they got away with it, they would have been getting away with it. It doesn't solve their problems. It doesn't solve their structural problems. And I can't see how any of the possible replacements they can bring in for Boxing Day are going to change those problems either.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that Wokes does provide quite a bit with the bat and could potentially provide quite a bit with the ball here. Just his numbers don't reflect that. So Wokes isn't necessarily the problem. As you say, it's the batting, right? They bat one more session in the first innings and they save the test. They lost 8 wickets across a 40-over period in the first innings. Case closed. You rarely win a test match if you lose 8 wickets in 40 overs. And so it goes. But, I mean, structurally, if you go through the list, Rory Burns batted well last night. Hamid's shown enough. Milan's batted brilliantly at different times. So has Joe Root. I mean, you're looking at Ollie Pope, probably as the clear weak link at the moment at 5. Sorry, make that at 6. They've had... Stokes batting at 5. So Pope, no, sorry, rather, it's, let me get that right. Who's batting at 5? Who's batting at 6? It's Stokes batting at 5.
Stokes
and,
5.
And Pope batting at 6. I think there is a strong case for moving on Pope. Not because he's a bad cricketer. He's just a bloke who's out of form in the middle of an Ashes series in Australia. That's not a great combination. Not a great place to start playing yourself back into form. So that does open the door maybe to Dan Lawrence or maybe Johnny Bairstow, but we'll see on that one. It's a shame they've sent the Lions squad home because I'd have Josh Bohannon in there myself. But, I mean, I've been saying this for 3 months. I can't believe he wasn't in the main squad. But you know what? Saqib Mahmood isn't in the main squad. He took 4 in the Big Bash last night. So if they want an extra yard of pace and a bloke who can reverse swing the ball, they could do worse than looking at Saqib for Melbourne. I know that Melbourne's a really good surface at the moment. Talking to Damien Fleming about it today, like it's really really improved across the last 2 or 3 summers. So it may not be that you need someone to reverse swing it, but he could be a bolter for next week. And then the fundamental question around spin is, do they back Jack Leach to bounce back from what happened in Brisbane? If so, he plays. If they're worried about that, then they have a problem because Dom Bess would be, I think, in a similar boat to Ollie Pope. Not to say he's out of form desperately, but you're asking a lot of a young player who the last time he was on the big, big stage at Ahmedabad in March, he didn't go well. And you'd hate to see him taken apart on day one of a test match like Jack Leach was on day two last week at the Gabba and effectively get him hit out of the series as well as their second spinner. So that remains a predicament for them structurally.
In terms of the quality of Australia, this is interesting because certainly personally, I've been underrating Australia all year. I thought they had had the wrong team for the T20 World Cup and they won it comfortably. I thought before this series that they had an advantage over England, but the two teams weren't that far apart. They've dominated. They've done it without their two main fast bowlers. They've done it without their captain, with a stand-in captain. And they never looked like being headed here. They were front runners all the way. And I think people may talk up, oh, it got too close in the end, but it always felt like the wicket was going to come one way or another.
I share that view. I mean, I think that on the broader question of how good Australia are, I still think they're like a middling test team. I can't kind of shake that, but they've made good decisions at the selection table. And you get rewarded for that at home, especially against a team who are ill-equipped to play against you. And by that, we're kind of returning to our conversation last night about speed. And England don't have it at the moment. You know, I'm sort of half-heartedly talking about Saqib Mahmood, but in their squad right now, they've got Mark Wood and that's it. And they're unclear about whether they can even play a spinner. And if they do, they don't know which one. So on that basis, yeah. Travis Head is at the right time getting picked. Marcus Harris, I could go either way on that. We debated it last night. I'm not sure. I think there's a bit of a misconception around Khawaja. I picked this up in the comments to our show last night that, like, well, Warner should have been dropped in England, not Khawaja. The problem was Khawaja got dropped after Warner made 60 at Leeds. I mean, the timing was bung for Khawaja to replace Warner. I'm sure had that decision been made after the fourth test or, you know, that would have been a different one, but they'd moved and made the call. If anything, Khawaja should have stayed instead of Harris. But anyway, that's bygones. But I just feel as though Australia, despite not being even remotely as good as you think they would need to be to win 5-0, I feel like from here they probably win 5-0. And I don't even think the disparity between the teams is that huge. It's just a case that England don't have the type of cattle that can seriously can compete here at the moment against an Australian team who are so well conditioned to winning at home and an outstanding bowling attack from head to toe. All five bowlers, class. We've seen that over the last 2 weeks. Expand that now to seven bowlers, including Cameron Green.
The Final Word Hall of Fame is where we find the most final word moment of the day. I don't think, I know this is obvious, but I don't think it can be anything else but Joss Butler standing on his stumps. And he didn't stand on his stumps in a bad, super uncontrolled way. He just went back and just nudged it with the back of his heel. As a correspondent, Billy Pratt, suggested to me, it was a piece of performance art underscoring the futility of existence to be, you know, for Joss Butler to be 26 off 207 balls and then kick his sticks over. It is Oh the Humanity. It belongs in the Hall of Fame. It probably deserves the top spot ever in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, I share that. Absolutely. I couldn't believe it. I was on comms at the time, and it's like one of those kind of startled pieces of broadcasting. You're like, you had to kind of watch it three or four times to make sure you haven't imagined it. Like, I haven't just missed the dismissal entirely, have I? I'll never forget that, absolutely. Can I give you a wholesome one? This was picked up on our call as well. Gold coin donation, which means that anyone can, you know, kind of come along who wouldn't ordinarily come to the cricket. And I went at the back to record a hit at lunch, and there were so many young kids there with their parents who probably wouldn't have been coming to the test if not for the fact that it's, you know, throw the gates open, chuck a gold coin in the box type thing. It's a great initiative doing it that way. I know that the way they do it in England's great too, with 20 quid and everyone can go, and, you know, because the ticket prices are so exorbitant there. But over here, I think it works so well that younger kids who perhaps wouldn't fit on a bustling test day with everyone on the piss, not everyone, but a lot of people on the piss, here they can kind of enjoy it with 6,000 other people and get a taste for it. And what they would have witnessed today, hopefully, will be the sort of thing that keeps them going and returning for years and years to come. I never forget my first day of Test cricket at the MCG in 1994. I talk to Flem about it all the time because he was very important that day. And I hope there's a whole bunch of kids who came here today who remember the day Joss Butler stood on his stumps and remember the day that Jai Richardson took 5 for 42.
You can remember, like, what colour jumper the guy in front of you was wearing, like, how long the delay was for the train coming in. Like, your level of recall is somewhat frightening.
Yeah, yes.
It's, you know, Dustin Hoffman with a box of dropped toothpicks. But I think we have come to the logical end of the show for the second test. It's the Final Word Ashes Daily, which means we'll be back on the 26th of December on Boxing Day in Melbourne. It'll be the third test. It'll be a Boxing Day test with the series still alive, crucially. England unlikely to win three back-to-back to win the Ashes, but yeah, you never know. Bradman Slot did it in 1937. Joe Root's a bit Bradman-y at the moment, so
imagine we had a test. Imagine we had a test like the one that started in January 1937 at the MCG. That was the middle of that series when Australia turned it all around. You know, probably the greatest, most interesting test match ever played. We can dream, Jeff. Mm.
Flip the batting order. Chris Wokes has shown he should be up top. So do what Bradman did. Flip the batting order, Joe Root. We'll have other shows up on the Final Word podcast feed in between now and Boxing Day as well. Jeff Lemon.
I've got one more. I've got one more Hall of Fame. Sorry, Jeff. I can't leave it out. I can't leave it out. It's a late nomination. Sure. Stuart Broad kicking away his third delivery, then reviewing it.
This is like someone running into the church when they're about to, when they say, does anybody have any reason why to object? You're like,
Broad using DRS, well, sorry, having it used against him once and using it once himself before getting off the mark before tee with a massive smile on his face. But I just love the audacity of kicking away Nathan Lyon around the wicket and let off on the basis of height on it. One of those referrals when you watch the projection, you can't believe it. A nod to Stuart Broad. He always keeps us thinking.
All right. Final word, Ashes Daily. See you next time.
Ta-da.
I had to go about it, write it out and find it myself.
That's it for today. Thanks from Jeff, Adam and me for listening. We will see you back here on the 26th of December for the famous Boxing Day test in Melbourne. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave us a review, which will help more people to find us. This episode was produced by Sophia Tarek, and The Final Word is produced by Bad Producer Productions and edited by James Hurley. The executive producers are Gabrielle Jackson and Melanie Tate.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.